interview with The Economist, the minister said Moscow helped Iran a lot during the 12-day war, and after that the two countries have been engaged in more cooperation than before. He also touched on Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Araghchi emphasized that Iran is in favor of reaching an agreement, but only if it is fair and balanced. He said Tehran rejects U.S.'s attempts to dictate its own terms in any negotiations. The minister stressed that the enrichment of uranium remains non-negotiable, though Iran is open to pledge zero nuclear weapons. Political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas says the US and Israel have focused on a proxy war with Iran after the failure in direct attacks. He believes that Iran cannot reach any viable deal with the current US administration.
They know very well through their intelligence agencies exactly what Iran's capacities are and what it can and can't do. If those capacities didn't exist, mark my words, the Americans and the Israelis by now would have completely destroyed Iran as much as they possibly could. So what they've been doing is they've been preparing other devious, more cunning ways of balkanizing Iran. And that is by, first of all, engaging with the likes of the MKO internally, as we saw during the 12-day war. They activated their sleeper cells, their terrorists. These people do not understand the language of peace. They don't understand diplomacy. They're not going to leave Iran alone until they destroy the current establishment and take hold of it through the World Trade Organization, through the World Bank, until they make Iran a servile state to the empire. They will not rest. You saw what they did in Syria. They carry on and on and on. Not to be trusted. Certainly, I don't think any deals will be done with the likes of Trump. They're liars by nature. Pompeo said it. We lie, we cheat, and we murder. That's the nature of the beast.
Israel continues to violate the fragile ceasefire in Gaza as the regime conducts almost daily strikes across the strip, killing more Palestinians.
They say there's a ceasefire. Where is this ceasefire they're talking about? Where are the guarantors of the ceasefire? Every day, 10, 15, 20 martyrs die. We wake up to martyrs and go to sleep to martyrs, and they say there's a ceasefire. Unfortunately, there is no ceasefire. The Israelis aren't abiding by the ceasefire, and there is nothing from the agreement they signed.
Five people, they were sleeping. They were children. Oh, people, children. What is the fault of these children?
An Israeli drone attack in Abasan al-Kabira near Khan Yunus has killed another Palestinian, the second such death in the area today. In nearby Bani Suhaila, east of Khan Yunus, three more Palestinians were killed in fresh strikes. These attacks follow Wednesday's deadly assault on Khan Yunus and Gaza City, where at least 30 Palestinians, including 17 children, lost their lives. Since the truce took effect in the Gaza Strip, Israelis carried out more than 400 violations, killing over 300 Palestinians. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war, which started in October 2023, has left over 69,500 Palestinians dead. Earlier we talked to our Gaza correspondent Muti Abu Musabeh to get the latest updates on Israel's ceasefire violations across the war-torn territory. Let us take a listen now.
While ago, the Israeli occupation forces continued their strikes and attacks against the eastern side of Khan Yunus City. We were able to hear several explosions booming in that area after the Israeli artillery continued to strike those areas extensively. And as you know, the eastern side of Khan Yunus City is still one of the focal points of those repetitive and frequent attacks of the Israeli occupation forces targeting the residential areas that were completely destroyed and decimated by the Israeli occupation forces. However, those areas are still witnessing more full attacks by the Israeli occupation forces, and here in the eastern side of Deir al-Bala city, the Israeli tanks opened their gunfire towards the eastern side of the city. And as you know, in a continuation of those attacks, this area is also witnessing more cruel and brutal attacks of the Israeli occupation forces. Needless to mention that the eastern side of Gaza City is still witnessing also more attacks of the Israeli occupation forces, particularly when it comes to the detonations of the Palestinian residential buildings. Dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings have been completely destroyed and detonated by the Israeli occupation forces since this ceasefire agreement came into effect, and the Israeli regime is still ongoing with this policy. they are still, as you know, wiping out those areas from any sort of any residential buildings there. We are talking about entire residential squares and neighborhoods that were completely decimated and wiped out of the map as a result of this ongoing policy.
Hamas has once again condemned the approval of the first reading of an Israeli law that paves the way for the execution of Palestinian abductees. The movement says the so-called law marks a dangerous step towards formalizing systematic killings inside the regime's detention facilities. Hamas says the Israeli law also turns prisons into arenas for liquidation of Palestinians under the cover of legislation. It described the move to legalize execution of Palestinians as a new and brutal form of legalized bloodshed that blatantly violates international humanitarian law. Hamas says final approval of the law will provide legal cover for the killing of Palestinian abductees and replace execution for previous slow death tactics, including torture and medical neglect. The movement said the international community, especially the UN, is responsible for the consequences of this catastrophic and unlawful escalation. The Palestinian prisoners' rights group also expressed deep concern over the law. The Astra Media Office says it will transform Israel's already biased judicial system into an openly political instrument of revenge. The Israeli occupation forces press ahead with violent raids on Palestinian towns and villages across the occupied West Bank, causing civilian casualties and property damage. In one of the latest incidents, two Palestinian teenagers were killed by Israeli forces in the town of Kafar Aqab, north of the occupied city of Al-Quds. Separately, four Palestinians were wounded during a major military incursion into the city of Nablus. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society confirms the casualties, which included a child who was shot with live ammunition. The raid lasted approximately 10 hours and involved Israeli forces attacking areas close to the National Hospital and the old city of Nablus, abducting several young men. Soldiers discharged live rounds, fired stun grenades, and forcibly entered shops. This operation led to the suspension of classes at schools and at Najah University. Since October 2023, over 1,050 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and more than 10,700 others injured as a result of violent raids by Israeli forces and settlers. Iranians have marked National Heroes Day, honoring martyrs whose sacrifices continue to shape the nation's culture of resistance. Families of the fallen, senior officials and cultural figures gathered in Tehran, where the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, issued new commendations for books recounting the lives of three martyrs. Moin Amini reports.
Vahdat Hall served as the venue for Iran's National Heroes Day. The event brought together people, including families of martyrs, officials and writers, to honor their heroes and reminisce about their legacy.
The key component of our strength lies in the role of families and women. Their support for the fighters ultimately contributes to hero-making and to the transmission of a culture of resistance to future generations.
Across Iran, people find heroism in those who gave their lives for the Islamic Revolution, the 8 years sacred defense, the nation's nuclear and missile programs, the fight against U.S.-backed Daesh, and the 12-day defense against the U.S. and the Zionist regime, offering the world a different definition of a hero.
The works produced in the literature of the sacred defense are of an enlightening and motivating nature, which is the same quality that contributed to the early spread of Islam.
The program was further enriched by the unveiling of three commendations written by the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the lives of three martyrs.
The book Endless Fever not only recounts the life of a paraplegic veteran, but also portrays the way a family confronts and copes with this situation.
It was God's will that I became the mother of a martyr, and I must express my gratitude to all mothers of martyrs for raising such children.
The young companions of Martyr Soleimani, who sacrificed themselves to fight terrorism and imperialist schemes, perhaps serve as the strongest proof that the future generations of Iran will continue the path of resistance.
The National Heroes Day is named for the day when Martyr Soleimani's letter to Ayatollah Khamenei marked the annihilation of Daesh. 8 years later, Iranians continue to resist oppression, whether through literature or on the battlefield. موین امینی تهران.
Pakistan's expanding military cooperation with China is drawing new international attention as questions grow over how this partnership is reshaping the region's security landscape. From Islamabad, the latest developments signal a shifting balance of power that is now prompting scrutiny in Washington and beyond. Our correspondent Ganwar Mohiuddin reports from Islamabad.
A new report submitted to the United States Congress has reignited debate over China's rising defense capabilities. Citing Pakistan's battlefield performance during the May conflict, the assessment notes Islamabad's effective use of Chinese-supplied weaponry. The congressional report highlights that the systems sourced from China played a decisive role in Pakistan's recent military success, pointing to Beijing's steadily advancing defense industry. The findings are seen by analysts as a sign that Chinese platforms, long dismissed in Washington as second tier, are now demonstrating reliability and precision in real conflict scenarios. Islamabad's expanding partnership with Beijing through joint exercises and coordinated training reinforces this shift.
Without a doubt, China has surprised the world. However, China's weapons and technology are not yet tested. China has not been involved in as many wars as the USA. So their technology will be new and surprising, but we cannot say for certain they can outclass U.S. technology.
These trends come at a moment when the United States is expanding its own deployments in South Korea and Japan and intensifying patrols in the South China Sea. Regional observers say the growing China-Pakistan alignment is complicating Washington's broader strategy to contain Beijing's military rise. For Pakistan, the cooperation offers technological upgrades and strategic diversification, while for China, it signals greater influence across South and West Asia.
From Islamabad's perspective, the message is straightforward. China's defense edge is becoming harder for Washington to ignore, and Pakistan's cooperation with Beijing is now part of that shifting balance. Anna Muhyiddin, Islamabad.
And that is a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you so much for staying with us. Goodbye from me, Bahman Roy.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kavitat Wai. In this edition of the program, we have the pleasure of having with us our guest, Henry Giroux. Now, Henry Giroux is a cultural critic. He is a writer, a university professor, journalist, and also sits on the board of directors for truthout.org. Henry Giroux currently holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department and is the Paulo Freire, Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy. Also, we should mention some of the books that he has written, such as Fascism on Trial, Education and the Possibility of Democracy, in which he co-authored with Anthony DiMaggio, and also The Burden of Conscience, Educating Beyond the Veil of Silence. Henry Giroux, welcome to Unscripted.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. Thank you for being with us. The intro, obviously, may be a bit long, but it doesn't do justice to the types of contributions that you have made, which is why we wanted you as a guest. And let's begin with one of the articles that you have written, Trump's Policies of Defecation. I'd like for you to explain to us why you did not, in a sense, appreciate the way that this was covered by some who thought it was comical, where you said there was nothing comical about it. And to use your words, we are witnessing the fusion of crudity, cruelty, and unchecked rage into a nightmarish performance of power where degradation itself becomes the ultimate pleasure.
I think that what I was trying to do in that piece and talking about Stephen Miller, I mean, and talking about Trump, was sort of get at the heart of what's central to this fascist regime. These are people who basically believe in hierarchy. They defile any notion of dignity. They basically enable forms of cruelty that translate into a spectacle. They have no respect for basically I mean, my point was that we're living in the United States. What is taking place is a regime that not only has a certain allegiance to white supremacist principles, but denies any notion of equality, any notion of justice, and any notion of dignity. I mean, and what they've done with this is something that's sort of characteristic of the 21st century. They really tend to think that they can use the spectacle to degrade anybody or humiliate or dehumanize anyone who wants to hold them accountable for the kind of ruthless power that they exercise both at home and abroad.
You know, that's what we're trying to figure out. And one of the reasons we have you on this program, Henry Giroux, is because we're trying to figure out what's going on in the States, not just what we see or hear, but really get into the nitty-gritty of the structural crisis, in some sense, that the States is experiencing right now. You know, when we hear news about how you have U.S. officials who are actually leaving their residences and going into military bases because they don't feel comfortable, or you hear about that Charlie Kirk assassination, or you hear about the National Guard being deployed to all major cities. I believe the 500 or so for each city has been allocated to that. And, of course, the No King's Day demonstration, which brought out millions of Americans across every state, 50 states is what I read on this. It shows that there's some kind of crisis going on. Can you tell us what the deal is there?
Well, of course there's a crisis. I mean, there's a crisis of civic consciousness. There's a crisis of democracy. There's an economic and political crisis. There's a crisis of agency. There's a crisis of dignity. There's a crisis of education. I mean, what we basically see in the United States is something that's totally at odds with what it often views itself as being an exceptional country. That meaning that it has viewed itself in the past, unfortunately and untrue, as a country that represents the highest pinnacle, not only of civilization, but also of democracy. And I think a contradiction is emerging now in the United States that makes it clear that not only is it not a democracy, but it's a country basically that increasingly, like other countries in Europe, whether we're talking about Italy or talking about India, whether we're talking about Hungary or Turkey, that has become increasingly authoritarian. And I think it's becoming increasingly difficult for this government to justify itself. So what does it do? Since it's losing its legitimacy as basically a government that serves people as opposed to serving a ruling elite, it basically becomes increasingly more militaristic. And as it attacks social problems, the punishing state becomes more powerful. And the notion of a war culture extends not only at home domestically, but also abroad, with, of course, the endless rhetoric about invading Venezuela or, of course, bombing Iran or any other country that it somehow seems to believe gets in the way of its totalitarian logics. But I think that what's most important here is the increasingly lawlessness of the United States government, the abduction of people without due process, the militarization of the cities, the attempt to militarize the army and to make a claim that it has no allegiance to the Constitution, it only has an allegiance to Trump, turning it into a sort of private army, the war on black and brown people, the war on immigrants, the war on refugees. I mean, all of these become a vehicle for basically asserting a kind of militarism and a kind of fascism that is increasingly becoming not only unpopular in the United States, but is alarming people. And hence we have no kings, and hence we have sort of protests all over the country. But I think there's something else that needs to be said. And I think that, you know, since the 1980s, the United States has been governed by something called neoliberalism, which is a really ruthless economic policy that concentrates wealth in the hands of relatively few people. And it makes the claim that the market is a measure of everything, of all relations. And it seems to me that what has happened in the last 50 years is that the market basically has failed. Neoliberalism has failed. There's increasing inequality. There's increasing despair. There's increasing poverty. There's increasing hunger, and it can't legitimate itself anymore. It's lost its mode of legitimation. So what does it turn to? It turns to fascism. It now says, yes, the country's in trouble. Let's blame immigrants. Let's blame blacks. Let's blame brown people. Let's blame refugees. Let's criminalize social problems. Being homeless is now a crime. Let's reinforce the notion that all problems are individual problems rather than social problems. And so I think that what we're seeing is a global crisis of capitalism. And that crisis is playing itself out with increased forms of militarization, an increasing war culture, an increasing war on its own citizens, massive inequality, and a refutation of democracy itself. Orban says we don't want democracy, we don't want mixed races, we want a liberal democracy. And I think that Trump is basically nothing more than an echo chamber for that logic. And I think that the contradictions are too obvious. People are rising up, and there's an enormous amount of discontent in the country over these issues.
Indeed, and you know, you touch upon so many issues, and the issue of immigration and the way that Donald Trump has dealt with it is really unbelievable. We had a guest in the previous show who was echoing the words of Trump. My question to you is, and he was saying, you know, Trump is right in the way that he's dealing with the immigrants and throwing them out of the country. And he blamed the Democrats for it, and he particularly zoomed in on Joe Biden and Barack Obama. That it was during their time in office that this happened. Now, I've lived in the States. I was there for 30-some-odd years. There wasn't really a problem that at least was visible. You know, multiculturalism obviously is something the U.S. stands for, including immigration. But, you know, you have people who actually believe what Trump is doing is right. How did they get convinced that that is correct? And why is it that then others obviously do not see Trump justified in what he's doing there?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question entirely because of the sound here. But there's a problem. And the problem is that what we're dealing with in the United States is a long legacy of white supremacy. And that legacy and the way in which it's manifested itself in the past has basically been on the fringes of society, though it's had an enormous impact in different periods of history, whether we're talking about the genocide against Native Americans, the genocide of African Americans during slavery and Jim Crow, the internment of the Japanese during World War II. And that legacy all of a sudden now is at the heart of the governing structure of the United States. And so this claim that immigrants are the enemy, this notion that white people are victims, this claim that America is only for Americans, which is nothing more than an articulation of white supremacy, I think that logic is so ingrained, has been so legitimated, been so naturalized, that it's not surprising for me to hear that Trump is right. It's not surprising for me to hear that racism being echoed not only by Trump and his white supremacist supporters, Stephen Miller, and a whole range of people. I mean, these people are outright fascists. They don't hide words. I mean, Stephen Miller, you know, gave a speech, a rally in Madison Square Garden, in which he said, America is for Americans. That line is out of Mein Kampf. That line is out of Hitler saying, Germany is for Germans. So I don't think we should be surprised by the historical weight of white supremacy and its enduring recurrence. I think that what we should be surprised about is how it's unapologetic and now makes no attempt to legitimate itself to a whole range of other issues. Oh, you know, immigrants are taking jobs. There are too many immigrants in the country. We need to do something about this. That isn't the argument anymore. the argument is that, look, citizenship is only for white Christian nationalists. Ultranationalism is the name of the game. And we really don't want people in the country who are either dissenting or brown, black, or from anywhere else.
Do you see that that obviously poses a great friction amongst Americans? And by Americans, I mean the ones who, you know, may have come from abroad, but they were naturalized and they became American citizens, vis-a-vis Americans who are, as you say, white supremacists, perhaps. And I'm going down the road here in my question to you as to what level of a boiling point have we reached? Because, you know, this keeps getting worse. I don't want to say by the minute, but it's getting worse. You know, the social friction that is tearing apart somewhat the fabrics of U.S. society, we see that in certain, I guess, states, more so in some than others. But how do you see that?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the social fabric of the United States has been ruptured with respect to the mythology that defines the United States. It's very difficult to talk about the United States as a democracy anymore when you have massive inequality and one family in the United States owns 50% of all the wealth of the bottom 50%. It's not a democracy. But I think more than anything else that what we're seeing that has really sort of undone the mythology of American democracy is the militarization of everything. The increasing attacks on the social state, and at the same time, the rise of what I call the punishing state, that all problems begin to be criminalized, dissent is seen as treason. I mean, these are contradictions that don't just bear down on institutions, the attack on education, you know, the attack on social critics, the attack on the media. They create and engulf a level of conformity and repression that really boils over. And basically what you see emerging here is a kind of polarization in which you get these hardcore white supremacists, whether they're in the far right media or whether they're part of Trump's party or whether they're part of the ruling elite, who really don't know how to defend themselves anymore except basically through force, sending troops into cities, playing up the danger of international relations, you know, bombing boats off the Caribbean with no due process, claiming that that people who oppose fascism are basically domestic terrorists. You know, when you label people domestic terrorism, when you use terms like this, that means they don't deserve due process. And I think there is a spirit of free speech. There is a spirit of academic freedom. There is a spirit of the need for people to have some sort of say, however limited in the government in which they define themselves, that's being eliminated. Right. It's not unclear. It's up front. And I guess the fundamental question that Americans are facing is, what kind of future do you want to live in? What are you giving up here? What exactly are the myths and the lies? I mean, you have a president who's a pathological liar. He's a narcissist. He's a warmonger. He's a guy who basically is a kleptomaniac. He's a guy who uses the presidency to enrich himself. He's a guy who basically is insensitive to anything that would hold power accountable. We haven't seen anything like this.
Indeed.
This is usually ascribed to places like, you know, Chile under Pinochet or the ruthless Argentinian dictator, you know, or maybe Orban or maybe what's going on with Modi in India. But all of a sudden in the United States, the face of fascism in the most powerful country in the world is on display, and they boast about it. They boast about it. But I think that there are two things here you want to understand, three things that are really crucial. One is the United States is basically turning into a police state. That's too obvious to debate anymore. Secondly, it seems to me citizenship has now been restricted to basically white Christian nationalists. Thirdly, the level of inequality in the United States is out of control. It's completely out of control. We don't just simply put people in jail for dissenting or abduct them and send them to some place in South Africa, in Africa. Now we simply have millionaires buy the media and then fire anybody who basically engages in the most trivial of dissent. I mean, think about the Charlie Kirk issue. You know, people who basically after his death said, hey, look, he has said a number of things that are really awful. I mean, you know, he denigrated black people. He claimed that gay people should be put in prison. And people were fired for saying that. People lost their jobs. You have to ask yourself, what's the red line here? You know, at what point do you say, that's it? You know, we cannot sort of in any longer believe, for instance, that elections are going to save us when they're controlled by the ruling elite. What does it mean to engage in mass mobilization, boycotts? What does it mean to have strikes? I mean, what other avenues are available to fight a regime that is absolutely intent on creating, are you ready, for what Trump called a unified Reich? That's a pretty powerful conception of the future, not one I would want to be a part of.
No, indeed. You know, you mentioned all these things, but then we're looking at, for example, what happened in New York with the race there, where you had Mamdani successful in his race. He won the trust of the Americans, at least in that state, and he was able to do that through the composition of what many would say would never be a reality. You know, his age, being very young, lack of experience, but aside from that, him being a Muslim, a Shia Muslim, etc. Do you think that, first of all, it's pretty incredible that he won, I mean, if you ask me, because I didn't know who he was a year ago, and I'm sure many didn't, but here we are. Why do you think he won? I mean, what does his win signify, in other words, in the context of what you were just talking about?
I think there are a couple of things, and I'm like you. I don't want to go hard left and say, well, it's not enough. I think that what Mamdani did is quite incredible, in that he resurrected a language that speaks to people's needs in ways in which they could recognize themselves. He talked about the things that bear down on the body: hunger, affordability, housing. And he did it at the same time by placing it within a larger political context that said, hey, look, this is not just about, in a sense, solving the problem of basic needs. It's about the problem of inequality, and it's about the problem of authoritarianism. These all connect together. And I love that notion of totality, that notion of not just separating a problem out and saying we have to deal with this, but saying, look, we have to deal with the system that produces it. Because that's about power. That's about class. That's about race. That's about gender. That's about the kinds of freedoms that are interconnected that you can't isolate. And I think that's very, very powerful. At the same time, I don't have a lot of faith in the Democratic Party at all. The Democratic Party is the party of Wall Street. They helped elect Trump. They don't believe in addressing workers' needs. He represents a new language, a new, it seems to me, voice for that party, a new way to talk about how to fight authoritarianism and fascism and inequality and so forth and so on, a new voice for the future. But it will be interesting to see if he can mobilize young people and others so that they cannot, that they either have to radically reform the Democratic Party or start a new movement. And that's the challenge that they're going to face. He's going to come under enormous attack on all fronts once he gets in office. Remember, Trump has already claimed he's going to withdraw federal funding for New York. I mean, can you imagine what that's going to mean?
Indeed.
In terms of how it's going to bear down on, I mean, you know, you've lived in the States, how it's going to bear down on people's lives. That's not just an overwhelming dark moment of repression. That's also an overwhelming moment of possibility.
Yeah, and it's incredible that Trump has said that. I mean, we can talk about Trump in terms of, I don't want to be politically incorrect, but slamming him for hours. But, you know, Mamdani's win points to something that, as you said, it's you say that the Democratic Party is not on a, not solid footing, but it's not really successful yet to make a comeback to its appeal with Americans. But at the same time, you have this win by Mamdani, which, by the way, it's a socialism, a Democrat socialist is how he's been described. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. But what I'm curious about is to why, for example, then there isn't a momentum for that third party, so that you could then have people vote for that party instead of the failures that the Republicans and Democrats at this point have dealt with.
Yeah, I know. I quite agree with that. I mean, I think that I mean, what Mandami represents to me is the emergence of a language stripped of mythology. It's a language that goes right at the heart of what it means, the whole power, particularly class power, accountable. It's a language that brings back into the political discourse the working class. It's a language that talks about the violence, not of abstractions, but of policies that bear down on people's lives. When you have to make a choice between food and medicine, you're in trouble. When you live in a country that has one of the worst health systems in the world because of its cost and its inefficiency, when you have this massive attack on education, which is really an attack on the imagination. You know, you can't talk about the future when all of a sudden all the doors for expanding the imagination and being able to think otherwise are closed. And it seems to me that what is so important about him is that he's reanimated that discourse, just as Occupy 11 reanimated the discourse of class and inequality. He's animated that discourse in a broader sense. Now, there's one other issue that we haven't talked about. You can't ignore the fact that he did something that seems almost impossible in United States politics. He criticized Israel.
Okay.
He did something the Democrats refused to do. He said, what we have here is genocide. He would arrest the war criminal Netanyahu if he came to the United States. That was incredible. And he mobilized thousands of young people who believed him and support that position, and who have been beaten, who have been expelled from their classrooms, who have been defamed. He supported them and said, look, youth are what we need. That vision is what we need to create a generation willing to fight for democracy in all of its forms. And that worked for him. And that was incredible.
That was incredible. And I'm guessing that one of the main reasons for that is what we have witnessed over the past 2 years, the world has, and I'm sure in the U.S., which has turned the tide in many ways, and that's the genocide that was executed in the Gaza Strip. When you say that that is something that is incredible that he did, and that is to criticize Israel, but yet he was able to win, and we should mention that New York State has the largest Jewish diaspora, so in that regard, I think it's about 1.2 million Jews who live there. That's incredible. Right. If you read some of the headlines in the Israeli press, it says Israel is on edge now that Mamdani has been elected. Why do you think? Where do you think this is headed to? Do you think that we're is a turning point here when it comes to the politics in the U.S.? Do you think that Israel then should be afraid, because we know how they react when you have, for example, Muslim congressmen, the Quad, I think it was called, in the U.S. Congress, where they were so intimidated by it. Can you paint that picture for us?
No, I think there's something is changing that you sort of imply and acknowledge that we can't overlook. And that is Israel can no longer hide behind the assumption that it's simply a victim of history. It can't do that anymore. It has ruined the concept of anti-Semitism in any legitimate way by using it to simply suppress dissent and roll it out anytime any criticism is made, even by the United Nations or various human rights organizations. It's so worn thin that Netanyahu's reputation as a war criminal is very difficult to ignore. But I think there's a second question there, a second issue. And the second issue is that, hey, look, you know, there are an enormous number of Jewish people who oppose Gaza. I mean, there are an enormous number of Jewish students who are involved in the pro-Palestinian issue. They're not anti-Semitic. They're fighters for justice. And I think, in some way, there's a sizable number of Jews in New York who actually hold that position and voted for Mamdani. So I think that there is a transition taking place. I think that Israel is losing its status in the world. It's now being seen as a rogue state. It's aligned, of course, with Trump. And it's being welcomed or portrayed into that family of rogue states, semi-fascist states, authoritarian states, of which it would deny it's not a part of. But it can't do that anymore. It's lost its legitimacy.
Taking a look at also the win by Mamdani, not to keep talking about him, but it was one of many wins for the Democrats, which many say was a rebuke to the U.S. President Donald Trump. You have victories in four major races. From what I'm seeing here, the governor races in New Jersey and Virginia, and the Prop 50, California's redistricting ballot measure. Are we seeing then a tide being turned here against the Republicans in favor of the Democrats? Is that a good thing?
It's a good thing. I think, as a matter of fact, the victory is almost overwhelming. But I think the most important speech I heard was actually from Gavin, the governor of California, who, while he celebrated the fact that they had voted to redistrict so that they could fight this illegal attempt to make voting irrelevant in the United States by Trump and his cronies, he also said, hey, look, this fight is not over. They're going to do everything they can to not only prevent people from voting, but to instill a climate of fear that leads to the impossibility of people believing they can do anything. Trump wants to turn everybody into a cynic. He doesn't care, you know, whether they go anywhere else, as long as they don't do anything or support him. Loyalty is everything for Trump, as it is for most dictators. I mean, remember, the first casualty of authoritarianism are the minds that would oppose it. And I think that what we're seeing is a reaction to Trump within mostly Democratic states, right? That is understandable. But I think it's now reached a level of intensity that it can spread to red states. Remember, you know, hospitals are being closed over this budget in rural America. I mean, the people who are suffering from this big, beautiful bill and the shutdown are basically poor people. I mean, largely as many Republicans as Democrats. And as I said earlier in the program, the contradictions that are bearing down on people's lives, the violence is so overwhelming that I think that what this election signifies is really a reawakening of the refusal to listen to Trump and to believe in a reality that he makes up that has nothing to do with their lives. The economic issue is going to hurt Trump. And it means that the United States will become either a full-fledged fascist state, and he'll declare martial law, he'll invent a terrorist attack, or he'll make up some other reason for basically suspending civil liberties, or he's going to lose. He's going to lose. He basically is in the worst. His ratings are worse than any president in history. He's arrogant. He's indifferent to criticism. And he's indifferent to the response that is happening in the United States. I mean, my piece on the politics of defecation, you know, is really about somebody who has lost his mind, right? Who portrays himself as a king, flies a plane, and defecates on a population that is protesting what he's done. How do we talk about that? I mean, what is the image there that we need to understand that gets beyond the so-called comic use of the spectacle to reinforce a sense of indignity and to claim that half the population is nothing more than, you know, amounts to nothing more than defecation? This is a serious issue. And I think that regardless of what he's trying to do to nurture and reinforce that issue, it's in crisis.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much. We are at the end of this interview, but it was very, very enlightening. Thank you for your thoughts. You gave us opened up a better window for us to look into the states and what's going on there. Henry Giriel, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, that does it for this edition of the program. You heard the statements there by Henry Giriel. We were looking into the U.S. politics, domestic issues, but it's quite enlightening to hear the way that the U.S. is dealing with some of the problems that it's going through a transition or reincarnation of some sorts. Of course, the U.S. President Donald Trump has a few years left in his tenure as the U.S. president. We have to wait and see how things are going to transpire during these few years. That does it for this program. Thank you so much for being with us. From Mikovit Hagway and the team here at Unscripted, it's goodbye.
Tonight, a tiny angel sleeps on my knees. She's only 5 years old, but her heart's bigger than the seas. Tonight, our house is filled with the sound of the angel's wings. She has so many more friends in the skies than on the earth. Oh, my daughter, you're my soul. You're my calm in the storm. All my dreams will come true 'cause of you. You are a part of me and the light of my eyes. Longing for heaven, I breathe in your scent anew. You're a part of me and the light in my eyes is you. Longing for heaven, I breathe in your scent anew. You shine like the moon and the stars revolve around you. You dream of a holy sun rising and this dead world starting to bloom. Oh, my daughter, you're my soul. You're my calm in the storm. All my dreams have come true 'cause of you.
Prior to urbanization and settlement of man, humans lived side by side nature. They moved to warmer areas during cold winters and vice versa. Today, not much is left of nomadic life, especially in Western countries. But in some countries, including Iran, nomadic life still continues to thrive and to flourish. Here in North Khorasan province, the Kormanj nomads continue to maintain their ancient heritage, just like their ancestors.
During summertime, many Kormanj nomads move to the plains around the city of Esfarayen. They stay there for more than 4 months. These farmlands are where their cattle can graze off the abundant remains of wheat and barley harvest that usually takes place in early August. The nomads lead a simple but happy life next to each other. This is one of the places where you can truly understand the meaning of togetherness.
The nomads follow a complete natural lifestyle. They are self-sufficient in many things, including many of the things they wear and what they eat, like this fatir bread with a taste of nature.
For us city dwellers, it may be hard to imagine living in conditions like this, but this is how the nomads live. These people are so determined. Life is not a joke around here.
Local sports and games are an inseparable part of every culture. Here in North Khorasan province, there is a type of wrestling which is extremely popular among the people. The locals say that it is one of the most ancient sports in the world. It is a part of every festivity and cultural event. It's known as wrestling with Chukhe.
In addition to Iran, wrestling with Chukhe is practiced in other countries as well, including Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and the Russian Republic of Tataristan. But North Khorasan is known to be the birthplace of the sport. History has it that Chukhe wrestling was a yardstick by which a wrestler's power and sense of heroism was put to the test. Chukhe is in fact the name of a vest which the wrestlers put on during the match. It is made of a thick cotton fabric and is considered as one of the most famous handicrafts of North Khorasan. North Khorasan is well known for its exclusive handicrafts, which shape a part of the people's culture in this part of Iran. Nargol Heydarian has been awarded several times for her lifetime achievements in reviving some of the forgotten traditional handicrafts of North Khorasan. Nargol currently holds an Academy of Traditional Handicraft in the city of Shirvan. Her goal is to help pass on her art and knowledge to young artists. Traveling around North Khorasan is like soaring among the pages of an old storybook in your dreams.
To the people in North Khorasan, preserving cultural identity is of great importance. That's why, regardless of their age and ethnicity, they spare no effort in passing on their heritage to future generations. I'm Amir Mehdi Kazemi, reporting for Iran. Iran is known for its four-season climate and the climatic variety in each of its regions. This time, the lavender fields of North Khorasan province have invited us so that we could discover a part of natural beauties in northeastern Iran.
This is a land of a thousand colors, with a wild and vibrant nature, where kings and poets have been inspired by its beauties throughout the ages. A place where fountains keep the rivers flowing like the never-ending tales of Shahrazad in the 1,000 Nights and a Night.
From some of the most arid deserts in the world, the habitat of the Iranian cheetah, to the greenest forests, pastures, and valleys, North Khorasan has it all. Here at the Baba Aman Forest Park, the combination of rivers, waterfalls, and the umbrella of sycamore trees have all created one of the most popular summer hideouts for the people in the region.
There are a number of forest parks in North Khorasan, and Baba Aman is one of the popular ones. In spring and summer, Baba Aman hosts the largest number of visitors. At first sight, the place resembles an oasis. What greets you here upon your arrival is the cool, gentle breeze that touches your face. The symphony of a flowing river and the terraced ponds in the middle of the park complete this good feeling. But our trip to North Khorasan is not all about nature. In this amazing region of Iran, there is a little town which could be considered unique, at least in Iran and its surrounding countries. The exceptional feature of this place unveils itself after a short drive in the town's only boulevard.
We have come to a little town in northeast Iran, a town with only 12,000 inhabitants. What is interesting about it is that it has more than 170 shops that only sell dried nuts and dried snacks, such as this one, which is called kashk, It's a combination of dried curd and herbs and spices.
Welcome to Farooj, the region's trade hub for dried nuts, trail mixes, and you name it.
One of the things that makes North Khorasan exceptionally beautiful is its untouched natural environment. Many believe that this region could be one of the main destinations for ecotourists in the near future. A few kilometers from the city of Shirvan, a village known as Gelian testifies to this fact.
We head towards a hidden paradise in Iran's northeast. Gelian, also known as Golian, is one of the 365 outstanding tourist villages of Iran. With a population of no more than 700, the inhabitants of this picturesque mountainous area are mainly engaged in farming and animal husbandry. Gelian is situated in a valley. The terraced structure of the village and its adobe buildings, along with very tall trees, are only some of the interesting features of this place. Some people believe that if you're born in Iran and spend an entire lifetime traveling across this country, you still wouldn't be able to see all the beauties of this ancient land. This may be true, but seeing at least a part of beautiful Iran would still be worth it. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Iran.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to you all. You are tuning to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with Reporters. Reporters from all over the globe tells us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from distant lands. That will be followed by Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. Our radio production's feature will be the next. And our final program this hour is The Last Savior. This program discusses the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. Everything about his government and his life. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
For months, Tulkarem's neighborhoods have been bulldozed, sealed, and emptied during repeated Israeli raids that have turned entire residential blocks into rubble. As the world remains silent, hundreds of displaced families say they have been left to endure their trauma alone, living between relatives' homes, UN shelters, or temporary structures with no certainty of what comes next.
Nur Sham's camp has suffered greatly, and it continues to suffer. The camp has been emptied of all forms of life. We are expressing our rejection of this enemy's policies. This is a stance of refusal, not a plea for mercy from the occupier.
As Duja speaks, her voice steady but heavy with exhaustion, the sound of live fire cracks through the air above us, a stark reminder that even simple interview unfolds under danger.
As much as we are filled with pain over the camp's condition, we are equally proud of it. We are steadfast. If we were not causing the enemy pain, it wouldn't commit all this brutality against us.
New Shams residents say that the same brutality crushing Gaza is echoed here in the West Bank, where nearly a year of displacement have pushed families into tents and overcrowded apartments.